From Chiron Return and for the Pacifica Network, this is Planet Waves FM. My name is Eric Francis Coppolino, your host. This is a special second segment of Planet Waves FM edition for December 4th, 2020. This is the segment that contains exclusively the interview with Dr. Kevin Corbett, described in the main part of the show above. I'll be back with a little more introduction in half a moment. Once again, welcome to part two of Planet Waves FM for December 4th, 2020. This is the segment lasting about 2 hours wherein I have an exclusive interview with Dr. Kevin Corbett. He's actually a nurse and a PhD in several fields that he will describe. And he is one of the co-authors of the retraction paper sent to a publication called Eurosurveillance. It was Eurosurveillance on January 23rd that basically single-handedly claimed that there was a novel coronavirus, an outbreak of a novel coronavirus that was going to spread around the world with just 4 deaths noted on the date that the paper was submitted on January 20th, approved in 24 hours and published 2 days later, approximately on the 23rd of January. And this paper, as I've said in detail in the discussion above, is the sole basis for the determination, first of all, that there was a novel virus, that there was an outbreak of what was thought to be pneumonia, that it was a coronavirus. And then the paper further gives the protocols for what's called the polymerase chain reaction test, the one and only test that's being used to calculate what is falsely being called the case count. And as we explore in this conversation, and as I explain in detail above in the second two segments of the program, which I do humbly suggest that you listen to, the polymerase chain reaction can only find what it's told to look for. You have to tell an assay what to do. You have, even when you have a search and rescue dog, you have to give it a little bit of something to find the person, right? You have to have like their underwear or a shirt or a hairbrush or something, and then your search and rescue dog can pick a person off a 40-acre parcel of land. Happens every day. I might not believe it had it not happened to me with my dearly departed friend, the mighty Quox, who found me and my then-girlfriend Danielle Warren sitting by the side of a stream on 40 acres of land in about 20 minutes. Well, the PCR is a fantastic hound dog, but you have to give it a sample of what to sniff for. And instead of being given a sample of real virus, the PCR has been, in this entire SARS-CoV-2 COVID crisis, been programmed with a synthetic set of sequences that do not exist in nature, or, said correctly, do not exist in nature as a virus. They exist, but they do not comprise a virus. They don't comprise proof of a virus. No one can have this virus, it's finding, because it doesn't exist in nature. So you might say, well, what are all these positives about then? Well, finding a lot of other things. It's finding all Asian viruses, means all flu viruses, or if you believe they exist, are coming up. Former infection with SARS, natural human RNA is being found, essentially anything but an actual sample of SARS-CoV-2. Now, this sounds just incredible. However, it has been written about all year, first by John Rappaport, an 82-year-old investigative reporter who today I described as a walking switchblade, who produced the government documents saying as much from CDC and FDA and the manufacturers. All agree this thing only finds fragments of genetic code that could be anything. So it is not a diagnostic. It does not find a case or confirm a case. It is incapable of doing so. It is not a diagnostic tool. And we're going to talk about this extensively in the ensuing hour and approximately 50 minutes, recorded on Wednesday. Kevin Corbett is a first of all, a specialized clinical nurse who assisted patients with AIDS for many years of his career. And then he decided, sort of in a mid-career move, sometime in the 1990s, to do a dissertation, do a doctoral program, studying the test for HIV and the impact of HIV testing on people and on the population. So he's both a scientist and a sociologist, and he is in particular an expert on viral testing, so-called viral testing assays, Western blot, ELISA test, viral load, and the PCR test. And so he is no stranger to any of this and has spent many, many, many years working on this and is listed as the 21st author on this external peer review, it's called, of the PCR test to detect SARS-CoV-2, which reveals 10 major scientific flaws at the molecular and methodological level, consequences for false positive results. It's like a 20-page paper. As you have probably heard, I deconstruct and explain parts of it above. As you probably know, I've been on this particular issue first and foremost all year long since I read John Rappaport's article. Poke around, you'll find it. It's I probably don't have the energy to link to it tonight, but I have talked about it and linked to it many times, and you'll see it if you read through my work. And so I feel at least like I knew enough going into this interview to interview and carry my end of the conversation with one of the world's foremost authorities in viral testing, and in particular, the use of the polymerase chain reaction test, Dr. Kevin Corbett, who will be speaking to us from London. I offer my deepest gratitude to the investigator journalist Celia Farber for setting up this interview. Without further delay, here is Dr. Kevin Corbett. I'd like to welcome to Planet Waves FM Dr. Kevin Corbett. Kevin is a scientist in the United Kingdom who is one of the signatories on something that's called the Corman-Drosten Review Report, which is challenging the validity of the polymerase chain reaction test, quote-unquote test, it's not really a test, that's being used to support the entire case count and the death count from SARS-CoV-2 and COVID disease. Kevin, welcome to Planet Waves FM.
Thank you very much. Nice to be on. Thank you.
I truly appreciate your coming on the program. It's an honor to have one of the signatories on what I consider to be the single most important scientific development of 2020. And you had a little competition last week with the study in Nature of 10 million people saying there's no asymptomatic spread, but maybe we'll get back around to that. Just briefly for our listeners, Kevin, what was your doctoral thesis in?
My background has been in public understanding of science and technology. I undertook work in the 90s on people's experiences of PCR testing in relation to the viral load tests used in HIV/AIDS medicine, but also in relation to people's experiences of HIV antibody testing and CD4 T-cell counting. Yep. So there's those three tests in the 90s that I looked at people's experiences of, which were quite variable, and the tests themselves had huge amounts of interpretive flexibility in what they meant. So, but obviously this was something that was concealed from the public, and the public were given this very tightly defined view of what these tests meant. But in reality, there was the alternative, meanings attached to these tests when you look at what the manufacturers say and when you look at what the research actually shows.
Right.
So that was my background.
So you it sounds like you were involved on the scientific level of having to understand all of the scientific technicalities of these assays, as well as on the social level of how the public understood or thought it understood what was going on. Is that fair to say that?
Yes, that's fair to say. And it's also important to see that I came out of the clinical context.
Yes,
as a clinical nurse, as a nurse specialist, I worked in the field of HIV/AIDS for years. And so I came out of an area of diagnostics where you're dealing with real patients and you have to make clinical diagnoses.
Yes.
And I think this is important when we look at COVID-19 and SARS-CoV-2 in this area where, the test is one thing, the diagnosis is something else.
Yeah, and the illness is another thing.
Exactly. And the illness is very often the person's experience or the patient's experience is the illness. The disease is the objective set of clinical signs, and the test results are something else. So all these things have to be brought into a mix in terms of, the differential diagnosis. And this is what's been... hasn't really reached the public sphere in terms of COVID-19. People are looking at a set of generic symptoms like cough, sore throat, temperature, whatever they say they are for COVID-19.
Yeah, difficulty breathing.
And exactly. And those are shared with hundreds of other diseases and conditions.
That's right.
And it's the spectrum of what the meaning is, what those meanings could be attached to those symptoms, that's important. And just having a PCR test on its own and set of those symptoms is being reduced to something called COVID-19 diagnosis.
Yep.
And that's not scientific medicine. That's a bastardization of medicine. That's a misdirection, a very skewed misdirection of medicine to interpret those symptoms as just due to COVID-19.
Well, or to take a PCR test and say you have a disease just from fragments of something found in a test, in an assay.
Well, yes. I mean, this is the issue that it's quite difficult, I think, for people to understand. And these tests. I mean, with the paper you mentioned, it's just been published by Peter Borger et al., and it's on a website, and it's a response to the PCR paper by Coleman and et al. In 2020, this year, January this year, and you're a surveillance. And there's 10 major areas of error, we argue, with the original paper. But with the PCR test, the PCR methodology, polymerase chain reaction, quantitative or qualitative, and that means that you're looking at the amount of something, or you're looking at whether it's there or not. The diagnostic is whether it's there or not.
Mm-hmm.
The quantitative is how much of it's there, and that's a very interesting scientific tool that was, the Nobel was given to Carrie Mullis for its invention. And a lot's been written about this already, so, it's all secondary information. So much in the public sphere about it.
Yes,
everybody knows that it's not a diagnostic. But what does that mean when the people say, well, the PCR is not a diagnostic, so it shouldn't be used to diagnose COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2. It means that it's got to, the test result on its own is one thing, but it's not a diagnostic on its own. It cannot be used to confirm medical diagnosis. And legally, and I'm sure it's the same in the United States, in the UK, only a physician can make a medical diagnosis, or somebody who's got that delegated responsibility, such as a nurse practitioner, which I had been, you can make a diagnosis legally and confer that onto a patient with a set of symptoms, a clinical history, and a set of lab results. That's how you make a diagnosis, not just on the test result. And the manufacturers of these tests were always very clear to disclaim these tests as a diagnostic. And when I first got involved in people's understandings of this, I was looking at the Amplicor test, the PCR test for HIV in the 1990s. And the manufacturers made it very clear that this is not a diagnostic test, that it has to be seen in a clinical context.
Yes.
You see? Yep. And I think the clinical context of these generic symptoms for COVID-19 has been totally elided in the public sphere. It's been totally whitewashed out of it, except when people have got pre-existing conditions, you know? And that's why you hear this statement, people have died after testing positive for COVID-19, but they died with pre-existing conditions. So they died with heart disease, hypertension, stroke, or you know, diabetes, or cancer, or some other pre-existing condition.
Yeah, 94%. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, it's overwhelming that these the morbidity in the population with the label COVID-19, the morbidity is pre-existent. It's not due to COVID-19. COVID-19 is a cherry that's been put on the cake, as it were. It's an artifact, a diagnostic category that's been created, you know, something that's come along very quickly as a result of a genetic sequenced virus,
yeah.
SARS-CoV-2.
Right.
And this is the thing with this this challenge, the Peter Borger paper, mm-hmm. Peter Borger et al., that there are specific errors in the Corman-Drosten paper, 10 of them.
Ten
categories of error,
yes,
have been highlighted about this PCR test. And it was very clear to a lot of people early on this year that there's problems with the Corman et al. Paper, the Corman-Drosten paper. And for me, the key thing about that paper was that they didn't have viral isolates. They said that in the paper. There's no viral isolate released by China. They developed this PCR test in the Corman et al. Paper, Corman-Drosten paper, through having a genetic sequence that was partial, it wasn't complete. So they checked it online with Chinese social media to see if it was a SARS-type virus. And that the nucleic acids, the missing bits of the sequence, or parts that were missing, were in a sense filled in,
yes,
or extrapolated from the existing sequences.
Yep.
I wouldn't like to say made up, but I mean you could use that word. I'm not sure if it's totally accurate, but certainly they were extrapolated. They were filled in, and so this to me, you know, as a social scientist, it indicates the strength, the power of genetic virology, where you're looking at a genetic sequence, a genetic code for something, rather than the morphology of something. Now, what I mean by that is the focus in virology in the last 30 years has been on the virus, has been on the genotype, it's been on the genetic phenomenon rather than the phenotypic, the environment, the substance, the morphology, and how that reacts with the environment.
May I interrupt you for a second? May I interrupt you for a moment? I think we need to put some context on to this Corman-Drosten paper. The paper was published January 23rd, and as I understand it, it establishes what is claimed to be the entire foundation of the pandemic. This paper contains what claims to be the existence of the virus, the claim of causation, and then finally the protocols for the PCR assay that was adopted by the World Health Organization. So the original, it's a constitution. The paper by Corman Drosten is the constitution of the pandemic. Is that fair to say that?
Well, I think you could make that claim, yes. I think, you know, it's certainly a fundamental paper that sets. And the fact is that the paper, it's not just Corman and Drosten. It's wider than that. It includes public health authorities across the European Union, such as Public Health England in the United Kingdom. One of the co-authors of the paper is Professor Maria Zambon. She co-authored the Corman-Drosten paper.
From World Health Organization?
No, she's from Public Health England,
okay,
which is United Kingdom
Pardon.
Agency, key agency within the National Health Service in the UK that coordinates all the national testing laboratories in the National Health Service. So all the COVID testing facilities in the National Health Service are coordinated through something called Public Health England. It's equivalent to your CDC.
Yes.
Okay. Equivalent.
So very high people in healthcare in Europe and the UK were involved in the signing on to this foundational document back in January.
Exactly.
And as far as I can tell, there wouldn't really be the claim of a pandemic accepted across Europe and the West without this paper. I mean, that's my understanding of this Corman, what we're calling the Corman-Drosten paper.
Yes, that's true. And you know, let me just read you out a couple of the affiliations there are 9 affiliations on that paper. The Corman-Drosten paper has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27 authors, the Corman-Drosten paper, 9 affiliations. Let me just read you out. Charité, which is the German Center for Infection Research in Berlin, TIB Mobile, Berlin, Germany, GenExpress, Berlin, Germany, Department of Viroscience, the Netherlands, National Institute for Public Health and Environment, the Netherlands, University of Hong Kong, Hong Kong, China, University of Marseille, France, Public Health England, London, UK, and Department of Medical Virology, Vaccine and Infectious Diseases Institute, Antwerp, Belgium, University of Antwerp. Mm-hmm. So you can see there you've got representatives across the EU from key public health agencies and research centres, and also China.
Yep. Yeah. I can't be wrong, then. Everyone signed on. How could all those scientists be wrong?
Well, science can be wrong.
I know.
Eric.
I'm being rhetorical.
Yes,
here.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's what will be, you know. And the one of the authors is Maria Zambon, who's the head of testing for SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19 in the UK. She's head of the testing service for the National Health Service, Public Health England. She's also Professor of Virology at Imperial College London, the same institution that did all the modelling for the pandemic that some people call a plandemic or scandemic.
Yes.
But I'll just call it pandemic.
Yeah, Neil Ferguson also works there. He's the one who said that 30-70% of the population,
right.
Because it was a novel virus, right? This paper is supposed to prove that it's a novel virus,
right,
which no one is immune.
Exactly. And basically, what has happened is that Peter Borger et al. And 21 other authors, one of which is me, have questioned this fundamentally. And Peter Borger et al. Paper is very key here because it's getting a lot of airplay. It's making a lot of arguments with solid scientific foundations that this Corman-Drosten paper should be withdrawn from Eurosurveillance, the journal, because there's so many errors in it, mm-hmm. even within the terms of reference of Corman-Drosten et al. There's so many errors in it. And shall I just go through what some of those errors are?
Yes. So this is the development that we're talking about. Was that now, yeah. you know, 9 months later, this initial claim on the 23rd of January has been answered mm-hmm. by you and your colleagues. And I would.
Well, yes, I mean, it's been answered by Peter Borger and his colleagues. He's the first author of the paper, and I'm very honored to have been asked to co-author it and to check the analysis and to co-author. But I'm not the lead author.
I understand. I understand. I do. Pardon me for giving you, you know, maybe more credit than you feel you deserve. But you know, everyone's in the band. Okay. So I would love to hear your, you know, what where do we start, you know, taking this down?
Well, let's start with some of the you know, I'm not going to say the easy bits, but. For example, the test that they developed in the Corman-Drosten paper, the workflow methodology, they call it, cannot discriminate between whole virus and viral fragments. So it cannot be used as a diagnostic for infectious virus. That's quite key, really, when you're talking about
this is central to the problem. This is central to the PCR problem.
Yes. So when we're told that the PCR for SARS-CoV-2 is a diagnostic test, that doesn't stack up, because when you look at the parts of the genetic sequence that it supposedly detects, it doesn't actually do that. It can't detect intact or infectious virus. So the public would want to know that, wouldn't they? That,
I would think
the test that's been marketed, that's been pushed to them on the media and the mainstream media and the press as being a diagnostic and as being 100% plausible, is not that at all. It's a fallacious story that they've heard. It's actually a lie, to be quite honest. The word lie is not used in this retraction paper at all, so that's me using that word. But I would say it's totally misdirected what the public have been told. Incredibly wrong. And we had this also, Eric, later in May this year in the UK, we're told that the antibody tests that were going to be used to detect SARS-CoV-2 antibodies were 100% accurate.
Yeah.
And that's another argument, not another claim that the UK government made over here. In all the media here, it's made in the Daily Telegraph and made in the Guardian, all supposedly quality newspapers. And it came through the BBC and everywhere. We had 100% accurate. And anybody involved in medical testing, anybody involved in the science of medical testing and the probability theory on which it's based, know that there's no such thing as 100% accurate test. There's no such thing as 100% specificity and sensitivity mm-hmm. of any test. Mm-hmm. You know, how many times it detects what it thinks it's supposedly designed to detect, how many times it detects that correctly, and how many times it doesn't. You know, they're always approximate percentages, you know. And when you look at this in detail, you can see that people have been told wrong information. So it's either misdirected science, it's science misdirected, a bit like what happened in 1930s Russia with the agrarian science, where it was misdirected in an anti-Mendelian, anti-genetic way mm-hmm. With inherited traits. Mm-hmm. And I've forgotten the name of the famous scientist whose work was part of that. And the Russian government backed this Russian researcher because his agrarian science was seen as Russian and not seen as non-Russian, wasn't seen as what, you know, it wasn't Mendelian science from German or Austrian genetics. It was Russian-bred, Russian-developed science, but it was wrong, and the crops kept failing because they were organizing their industry around the incorrect science. Just as these tests for SARS-CoV-2 keep failing. They keep giving incorrect results. They keep giving discordant results from one series of tests to the other, and you get people testing positive and negative repeatedly, which is bizarre, really. So you'd think that there'd be some learning here. So that's one of the ten fatal errors in their tests.
Can we sum this up for our non-expert audience? Can we just sum this up? Tell me if I've got this right. The polymerase chain reaction tests for molecules, basically. And the molecules are said to be unique fragments from this novel virus that we're told exists. But instead, it does not find the whole virus, and the fragments it's finding do not indicate infection by the virus. Therefore, they don't indicate the presence of infectiousness or disease or symptoms or anything.
Well, I think that's correct. That's a very good way of putting it.
Okay, so we knew this, but now it's we're being informed in purely scientific terms why that is. And so let's go to the part about the synthetic virus being used without any clinical samples. Right, they've written computer code to put into the PCR machine, right? Is that fair to say that they wrote code?
Well, what's happened is that paper was published, the Coleman-Drosten paper was published in January this year. You gave the date, was it the 23rd or
24th? Yeah,
123, yep. Since then, and when that paper was written, they made the comment in that paper that China did not have an isolate.
Yes.
But it said in the Coleman-Drosten paper, in the present case of 2019 new novel coronavirus, viral isolates or samples from infected patients have so far not become available to the international public health community. That's what they said. In the present case of SARS-CoV-2, which they called the novel coronavirus then in January, viral isolates or samples from infected patients have so far not become available to the international public health community. Since January, there's papers saying they have. So there's papers saying they have viral isolates, and there's a paper from the CDC in the summer where they argued they have got a viral isolate. When I looked at that paper from the CDC, they swabbed one person who'd been to China, who had symptoms of COVID-19, and without appropriate controls, I'd argue, they proved that it's SARS-CoV-2.
They got a PCR hit. They didn't have viral isolate. To get a PCR hit off of a swab is not isolate.
No, but they said that they isolated it.
Yes. Well, there seemed to be
co-cultured. They co-cultured within. They used all sorts of methods, laboratory-based methods, to isolate it. And the question is, did they purify it? They said they isolated it from one patient, N equals one. One patient who said he'd been to China and who had the symptoms of COVID-19. So a lot of presumptions over that paper. Yeah?
Right.
A, because, they assumed that somebody been to China had symptoms of COVID-19, had SARS-CoV-2. They could have had flu, because the symptoms are so generic. And secondly, questions over whether appropriate controls had been built into the research design of that laboratory investigation, which I'd argue they hadn't been. And this is what you see with all these papers saying they've isolated the virus, when you look at them, a lot of them are saying they've just used PCR to detect
Yes.
A virus,
yes.
Which we know is completely fallacious. The second thing is they haven't co-cultured. And if they have co-cultured, they've done it in vero cells. They've used all sorts of impure media in which to grow or to culture a virus without appropriate control. So you don't know what they're detecting is actually live virus. And then they show you electron micrographs of a couple of budding cells from a surface, and you're expected to believe that that's the virus. And what you need to see is thousands of viral particles, all similar, and have the same nanometer measures across the field, and you don't see that. Mm-hmm. And I'm just talking as a social scientist, looking at this in a broad brush way. But I mean, you've got a variation here of what to believe and what is truth. And as much as the CDC and the public health authorities in Europe are saying there is a viral isolate, other voices are saying there aren't. And then if there is a viral isolate, why isn't it held in each country? Mm-hmm. Where is the viral isolate in the UK? Where is it held? I asked Maria Zambon, who co-authored that paper by Corman Drosten. I asked her in May, why don't you isolate the virus to calibrate the test? Her answer was, because the World Health Organization tell us not to. And she gave me the paper that said this on page 4, the World Health Organization paper on laboratory diagnostics for SARS-CoV-2. And it said the World Health Organization doesn't recommend viral isolation for diagnostics. So therefore, it hasn't been. And two other people in this country have submitted Freedom of Information Act requests to Public Health England here in the UK, and they've been told it hasn't been isolated. They don't hold it in a pure live form anywhere. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it's fascinating. And it comports with a CDC document from July, it's still current, it hasn't been replaced, where the CDC, in explaining what it's priming the PCR with, says that since no quantified virus isolates of 2019 nCoV are currently available, assays designed for 2019 nCoV RNA were tested with characterized stocks of in vitro full-length RNA and then mixed with human cells from the A549 line to mimic a clinical specimen. Clinical specimen. So that sounds to me, after thinking about this for months and talking to everybody I can talk to, including David Bettini in Italy, is that they are testing for a virus that does not exist in nature.
What they're testing for is a genetic sequence, you see, because, look, I've gone back through 30 years of virology and I've looked at textbooks over the years. People warned. Virologists in the 1990s, like, I'm just thinking the names, Kalischer, Bernard Fields, famous virologist, wrote huge volume, two-volume book on virology, and Fredrickson and Kalaman, they all argued that geneticization of virology is very useful. We'll have gene banks, and we've talked about this in the 1990s, we'll have gene banks where we can have viruses coded and we can access them. But the morphology of the virus is also important, the reality of it.
Yes. Its physical existence.
Where exactly the purified form is important. Its morphology is important because a genetic sequence does not equate to a live, infectious, transmissible virus.
Yes.
And that's, you know, and I'm looking at this as a social scientist historically. I'm looking at the reality here. And looking at it clinically, Eric, I came out of the clinical sphere. We're dealing with a real patient. You're not dealing with a set of surrogate markers on a blood sheet, on a blood test. You're dealing with real people. And you're telling real people, you've got something in you that's exogenous, it's come from outside, it's infected you, and it's going to hurt you. And that's what we do with patients every day. Yes. That's what doctors, nurses, and therapists do all the time. It's called diagnostics. It's differential diagnosis. That's what I thought had gone badly wrong in HIV medicine in the 80s and 90s. It became a technocratic form of medicine where the patient was distilled to an essence of blood tests, surrogate marker tests. And that dominated in HIV medicine. You know, you'd have virologists saying this patient's a viral cure, the viral load zero, the CD4 counts over 1,000. And I'd say, have you looked at the patient? The patient's dying. The patient's cachexic. The patient can't eat. The patient's lost huge amounts of muscle mass. The patient's this, the patient's that. They're looking at the blood markers. And the blood markers may mean one thing, but the reality of the person is something else. And all doctors know this, and nurses. All clinicians who treat real people know this. Yes. And I think what's happened in virology is the geneticization of it has become so sophisticated and so overriding and overwhelming. It's gone ahead of itself, and it's gone ahead of the reality. And it's ignored these well-known virologists who warned us in the 1990s and the 2000s about the geneticization of their field, the focus on the genetic code, the genetic sequence, as opposed to the morphology of the virus. Mm-hmm. And I'll just give you a little quote on this, if I can,
sure.
From a very well-known, I'm just opening it up for you. And it's from, let me have a look. Yes, from Fredrickson Relman in 1996. Now, these were two virologists who published a paper in 1996 called Sequence-Based Identification of Microbial Pathogens, a Reconsideration of Koch Postulates. And they published this in Clinical Microbiology. And it's a long paper. It's over 20 pages long. And in it, they made this statement, and I'll just read it out to you. They said on page 24, quote, with only amplified sequence available, a biological role or even existence of these inferred microorganisms remains unclear. Mm-hmm. And the absence of a purified intact microorganism prevents experimental reproduction of disease. Koch's third postulate, close quote. Mm-hmm. That's what they said in 1996, Eric.
Yep.
And we're now 25 years later, nearly, dealing with this so-called epidemic of testing, I'd say, mm-hmm. based on no viral isolate or questionable viral isolate, mm-hmm. perhaps I should say. Does that make sense?
Yes. And from what I've looked at, my research into whether there's viral isolate, because people claim there is, and we have the McMaster Sunnybrook claims, which haven't been published. It seems to me that every claim of viral isolate merely means they got a PCR positive on a swab, but that they are not testing for something they previously found. I mean, it's almost like saying we have this fingerprint and it convicts the person, but the fingerprint was never found at the crime scene.
Exactly.
But you're convicted right?
Exactly. And Fredrickson and Relman also said in the same paper, they said, quote, certain aspects of PCR amplified tissue-based microbial identification methods pose added difficulties for proving causation. So what they're saying there in those two quotes is that, you know, you can amplify any genetic material you like, and you can infer what you like. But the reality is, unless you've got the purified agent, and you know it's the purified agent, you can't extrapolate causation from that.
Well, having
a gene sequence and identifying what you think are bits of that gene sequence in human beings, which is what the PCR is doing for SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19, doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
It has no known accuracy. Those tests have no known accuracy because you haven't got, you're not calibrating that whole process with the purified agent itself.
Yes. Well, this is
And to develop a PCR test in January this year, the workflow methodology and the Coleman-Drosten test, without the viral isolate, surely is fundamentally, well, this is what we're arguing.
Yes.
Is not just incorrect, it's a contradiction in terms.
Yeah.
And these are virologists I'm quoting here, Fredrickson and Relman, 24 years before this year, said this in very authoritative paper, you know, that's about how you use cautious postulates with viruses. That's what they were doing in that paper in 1996. They were drawing up a way of using cautious postulates for sequence-based identification of, you know, which is viral identification, how you develop, how you apply cautious postulates to sequence viruses.
The fundamental flip here, if I may cut in, the fundamental flip here is that Koch's postulates are designed to help figure out why people are sick. They're not designed to take populations of millions of people with no symptoms at all and say, you're sick because you have this fragment.
Exactly.
It's a flip. It's a complete reversal. And the effect of the reversal is to diagnose millions upon millions of healthy people as not only being carrying a disease and potentially contagious, but as a kind of a biosecurity threat.
Well, exactly. And this is what Borger et al., this is what we're saying. I mean, another key part of the paper is that the Coleman-Drosten paper, you know, in terms of the amplification cycles, it didn't, this is well known now, but I mean, this is what we're saying is that emission of the CT value, you know, there's no threshold value given for saying what's a positive, what's a negative.
Yes.
There's no cutoff value. What we call in testing, what they call in testing, is a cutoff value for the test, whether it's positive or negative. And therefore, what you've got across different nations of the world and different laboratories within and between nations are different cutoff values applied to what is positive, what is negative. We had this with the HIV antibody test, Eric. We had this with the enzyme-linked immunosorbent assays used for HIV. The optical density cutoff varied, and it always does vary on the population you test.
Yeah.
You have to calibrate the test to the population at risk that you're testing, whether it's low or high risk. Now, with these PCRs for SARS-CoV-2, there's no calibration. I would like to know what they're using as the cutoff for low-risk populations that they're testing in Liverpool, where they went in with the British Army a couple of weeks ago, and they were testing school children and school teachers. Are they seen as high-risk or low-risk? Well, children should be almost zero-risk, because there's been no children who've had a diagnosis of COVID-19 who've died, as far as I can see from the UK or the US statistics. Am I right there?
As far as I know, and if they have, it's highly questionable.
So are they applying a different cutoff at those thresholds? And I think this is the very technical aspects in Peter Borger et al.'s paper that are very technical, but they're pointing to the technical Achilles heels
yes.
in the use of this test. And they're very specific. Some of them are about the primers. The high concentration of the primers are wrong. The primers are what you start with.
We should just define our terms. The primer is what you tell the test to look for. Is that right?
Exactly, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So it's like the word in the word search. Looking in a document search, right? You look for the word "the." You're going to find it a lot of times.
No, if you're looking at a definition of what the primer is, let me just go to. I'm just opening the paper, sorry, and I just want to be accurate here.
It's a sequence, right?
Yes, I mean the let me just read it out to you.
Please,
RT-qPCR, Protocol for Detection Diagnostics of 2019 New Coronavirus, and the manuscript suffer from numerous technical and scientific errors, including insufficient primer design. So insufficient primer design and problematic insufficient RT-qPCR protocol. So insufficient primer design. And what we've said, what's been said about that is the primers and probes, the concentration of the primers and probes should be of a certain range, which they're not, must be specific to the target gene, must be optimal percentage, and for virus diagnostic tests, you need at least three primers and must detect three viral genes, preferably as far apart as possible in the viral genome. And this is what this test by Drosten doesn't do. It doesn't do these very fundamental technical things that it should do. So within their own terms of reference, forget yeah. about the viral isolate issue.
Yeah.
Just put that to one side. Even within their own technical terms of reference, the Corman-Drosten paper fails. And it also fails because it looks as though the paper hasn't been properly peer-reviewed because it was accepted one day and within 24 hours it was recommended for publication.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, it was submitted and then recommended for publication within 24 hours. So that's when we review papers for journals,
it can take months.
Sometimes it can take months because you usually have at least two or three reviewers.
Mm-hmm.
They usually take quite a while. I mean, if you're very expert at it, you can turn it around in a few hours usually. I mean, I take a few hours over papers. This is then my area, the main area of expertise. You can do it very quickly because you know how to drill down to the methodology and you know the essence of where to go with the paper. But usually you've got two to three reviewers. One does it quickly. The other takes a while. It takes a few weeks at least. You know, you might turn it around in 3 or 4 weeks.
But not overnight.
Not in 24 hours. Not in 24 hours. And so this is the other issue. And then there's other issues with the authorship of the paper, Eric, that the conflict of interest. Very key conflict.
Well, Drosten's on the editorial board of Eurosurveillance, for example. So, in essence, he approved his own paper.
Well, no. I mean, they'd have to come back to us on this, but there'd be a way around that. No, people are on editorial boards all the time. I've been on editorial boards and submitted papers to a journal. I was on the editorial. I wouldn't review that paper. And I wouldn't recommend it for publication.
Okay.
I've never been an editor of a journal, but I've been involved in editorial committees for journals where I've submitted for publication. We all have. But it has to be watertight that there's Chinese walls there. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, of course.
And that's maybe an unfortunate word to use on this program. But a Chinese wall is
made of paper.
It's a watertight situation where there's no conflict of interest. You don't have anything to do with that paper. If you're an editor of a journal and you submit a paper for that journal to publish, it should be done behind closed doors. It shouldn't be done behind closed doors. You should have nothing to do with the editorial approval of that.
But we don't know that. Yep. We don't know. I mean, that's listed as one of the potential conflicts in part 10.
I don't think there's just that. I mean, the conflict
of interest
is just that.
There's much more.
Two authors of the Drosten-Corman paper, the Corman-Drosten paper, on the editorial board. A conflict of interest was added on July 29th that wasn't declared in the original version.
Mm.
And there's also, you know, corporate interests involved here that are quite key. So any of your viewers, I'd advise them to go to the CormanandDrostenReview.com, where we've published this retraction article asking for the Corman-Drosten paper to be retracted, because we go into detail on this. And it might not mean much to read it out to you on the
air. Got that. And I'm going to introduce this previously. So a couple of other things. It sounds like the primer issue is that the primers used are not specific enough and don't take safeguards to make sure that they're finding the right thing.
Well, it's the high concentrations of primers in their protocol that's problematic.
Can you explain that to me?
Which lead to... Well, it's the concentrations of the primers lead to increased non-specific bindings and PCR product amplifications. So what we're saying is that it's the concentration of the primers that is wrong and that leads to false positivity.
Concentration means too close together. They're too close together to pick random sequences.
Exactly. That's the idea we're saying.
Now I understand what that's a very simple concept.
And they lead to non-specific bindings and PCR product amplifications, which mean false positivity. And that's what makes it unsuitable as a diagnostic to identify SARS-CoV-2. And that's within the terms of reference of their own test.
Yes.
So, you know, irrespective of viral isolate, you know, put that to one side, it doesn't do what it says on the tin. Do you have that term in America?
Well, we all get it.
Yeah, you get it. And you know, there's other technical issues, like I mentioned, and there's the issue about whole virus, viral fragments, and whether it can detect infectious virus, which we're arguing can't. The amplification threshold hasn't been... determined. And you see, that's a very key issue with something like the PCR, is the amplification threshold. And everybody knows this.
Yes.
Look, I've been
the general public.
Everybody except Boris Johnson and the sage scientists in this country, and probably Anthony Fauci knows it.
Oh, no, he commented on it specifically.
Oh, he commented on it. Yes.
Oh, yes.
He
said that above 35s. Okay, let's quickly just go through this CT issue for people. I've taught it 20 times on the program. The polymerase chain reaction finds something that it's told to look for. And we now know that what it's told to look for does not exist in nature, that it's not accurately defined by the primers. Okay, good. Yeah. Now it's going to find something, maybe a molecule or two, and it's going to amplify it by doubling it each heating and cooling cycle. And then waiting, the computer, it's an AI device, and it's waiting until it sees enough of this for the bell to ring. And they're supposed to set every one of these has a limit of where it's going to cut off, and if it doesn't find it by the cutoff, it's negative, theoretically, and if it finds it by the cutoff, it's positive, theoretically. Therefore, the more heating cooling cycles you leave, the more doubling you get, the longer you leave it on, the more likely you are to get a quote positive.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Did I get that right?
So basically, I mean, how I put that is the more amplification cycles you go through, the higher probability of a positive end.
The more you're going to get.
And therefore, it's that sort of curve that goes up towards positive. And this is why, if you look at the standard operating policy for the UK from the National Health Service, you can see that they're doing over 35 or over 40, because it mentioned those numbers in the standard operating policy. So it doesn't say there's got to be a specific, number for the CT,
But he did recommend 45 cycles, so he's not taking any chances.
Well, 45 is a high number.
It's ridiculous. But we have him saying 45. In early correspondence, he's recommending 45, which anyone who knows this device understands this is ridiculous.
Well, this is why it has to be challenged, you see. And I think, you know, I'm not because I'm on this paper, but I was asked if I'd be a co-author, and I looked at it very carefully, this paper, and I think it's a very good paper because we're putting this forward very clearly in a scientific argument that is going to be very hard to rebuff. And what you've seen this week, Eric, is various quite despicable aspersions made about some of the people who authored this paper.
Yes.
By people who've authored the Cormann-Drosten paper. They've come back, not with scientific arguments to rebuff, which is the normal protocol in science. You come back with scientific arguments. You don't come back and disparage the personalities who published the paper.
No, they claim one person had been hospitalized for a psychiatric issue at some point in their life. This is not a fair rebuttal to a scientific paper.
No, it's not a scientific. I mean, this is despicable behavior. I mean, and you see, this is what happens. You see, look, in 1999, I co-authored a paper in a journal called The Practicing Midwife, which is a practice-based journal in the United Kingdom for midwifery, for midwives, obstetric nurses, you might call them in America. Mm-hmm. And we published data on the HIV antibody test. And we published issues around the caveats of the test, which is similar to this, similar to, you know, about the sensitivity and specificity of the test and the reliability of it. And we published data from the manufacturer's data sheet on the Abbott Laboratory HIV antibody test. And do you know what happened as a result of that? Public Health England, which is then called the Public Health Laboratory Service, phoned up the editor of the journal and wanted it stopped, wanted the run stopped, the journal run stopped. They asked for it to be pulped because who were these people publishing this information that was all incorrect on the test?
Pulped meaning shredded? They wanted
stopped. They wanted it stopped. I think they used the word pulp, but they wanted it stopped. And they said the journal should not be publishing this information on the test because it's wrong. And all we did was to publish what the data sheet said on the test. Mm-hmm. All we did was to publish that and to question what the public health authorities in the UK were saying in the 1990s about the 100% specificity and sensitivity of the test.
Yeah? As opposed to what's actually in the specifications, which obviously don't claim 100%.
Yes, which is, you know, you could test positive for all sorts of reasons other than HIV and the
pregnancy.
Data sheet.
You could
pregnancy prior vaccination, immunization, all sorts of phenomena, insults to the host, to the body, all sorts of insults, and that's the word they use, immunologists, insults to the host, could give you a test positive.
Yes.
And therefore, in the differential diagnosis, a clinician would have to take into account your history of your vaccination, your history of all sorts of medical procedures, and if you'd had a blood transfusion. Or if you're a woman, had you had a prior pregnancy?
Mm-hmm.
Did you have HLA antibodies? Because those can also, in those tests in the 1990s, could give you a false positive result. And that's all we were saying in the article. And the public health authorities were so angry that we focused on the Achilles heel.
Mm-hmm.
They came back and they tried to besmirch our characters.
Yes.
And say we were crazy or we were lunatics or something like that, you know. But they had to actually publish a rebuttal article. So we published an article giving all these problems, caveats over the test. Then the Public Health Laboratory Service published a second article in the following month's edition of the journal. So there was a debate about the test. in front of the people who are going to use the test, the midwives, the obstetric nurses, who are actually being asked by the National Health Service to test all pregnant women for HIV. So this is educational, you see, for the professionals involved in testing. They started to realize that it's not watertight. There's no such thing as a 100% accurate test. That there are all sorts of technical, scientific issues to do with how the test is run, the technical limitations of the test, and the context within which the test is taken,
yes.
The patient. So this is what I'm saying about going back to face-to-face diagnostics, you know, with doctor, nurse, and patient in front of them. That it's always, that's what you come back to. You know, and we've gone away from that, and we're being pushed away from that in this era of telemedicine now, and viral hygiene and medical military quarantine, where people are saying we don't need face-to-face diagnostics, that doctors and nurses don't need to be personally present with patients. It can be done over the phone or online or telemedicine on a screen. And I would argue, no, you can't do clinical medicine in that way.
Yep.
You do need hands-on diagnostics.
Well, I mean, to pull up in a parking lot and to have a technician shove a thing up your nose and then to be told that you're a confirmed case of COVID, to me seems so over the top, I can't even believe it's happening.
Well, I call that a bastardization of medical practice. You treat cattle better.
Yes.
Because
you to.
Cannot do humane medicine. You cannot do scientific medicine that way. And if you do vaccination like that, well, there we go. That's what we're doing, isn't it? That's what the government wants us to do now, is to train people off the street to give out vaccines to the public. There's going to be huge problems with that in terms of safety and efficacy. Mm-hmm. But there's huge problems with the vaccines anyway, but maybe we're going off the topic there, PCR.
Just to follow up on the issue of false positives, you know, the New York Times reported in 2007 that the PCR was capable of getting 100% false hits for pertussis. There was the Dartmouth incident. Do you know about this?
That's right. Yes, I know about
Dartmouth-Hitchcock incident, where they were claimed to have 142 or something cases of pertussis. Mm. Not a single one of those was true. But it completely upended life in the medical school. Pertussis would be a serious outbreak at a teaching hospital because you have old people and babies and everyone there. And it turns out no one had it. And so the community was on notice in 07, and you have virologists and others, epidemiologists, in the New York Times, in this article by Gina Collada, saying that you can have false outbreaks, pseudo-epidemics, they're called. And up to 100%, none had it. So then after a number of us in the alternative press kicked the issue around all year, particularly John from No More Fake News, drawing a blank on his name, and then Celia Farber, and Off Guardian's been fantastic. Planet Waves did the piece, my publication, in July. The Times came out and said that this could have 90% false positives, and we knew why. Because the probes were so narrow that any Asian virus could come up, past colds could come up, immunizations could come up.
Yeah.
And then your paper says, and Rasnick said, that healthy human DRNA sequences can hit positive in this assay.
Yeah, So basically, in these PCR assays that you're using for SARS-CoV-2, you're actually getting positive results because you're detecting your own genetic material.
Yeah, that you were born with.
Well, so it's weaponization of you against yourself.
That's right.
You know, they're weaponizing your own. You know, they're saying you're pathologically infected with something, whereas what the reality is that the way the test, the way the technicality of the test is designed, it's too broad. You know, it's like this. A fisherman's nets are too, the holes are too small, so you're getting huge amounts of fish in, different sizes, yeah?
Yep.
Not the ones you want.
Yep.
So it's the same sort of, you know, it's a metaphor really to try and explain to people how this test works.
Mm-hmm.
The PCR wasn't designed to diagnose. It was designed, it's a methodology to amplify genetic material or what you think is genetic material. It's not a medical diagnostic test.
Mm-hmm.
And it's being used by non-clinicians, non-registered, people who are not even doctors or nurses, employed as technicians who are given maybe a couple of hours training to go out and test the public like they're sheep or cattle and then give them a medical diagnosis. That's not a legal diagnosis to say that you're a positive case and you've got a transmissible infection when you're tested in a car parking lot by somebody who's not even a physician or a nurse.
There's all kinds of problems with this.
How can the public even accept that, Eric? That's what I'm asking.
Well,
why are we accepting this, you know?
Well, because you did your thesis on this.
Yeah, well, exactly. I wouldn't accept it from a doctor, let alone a non-trained, you know, if a physician said to me that this is not, look, these PCR tests are fast-tracked. This is all in the public domain already. If you look at the Roche test that used in the States, the patient and the physician leaflets say that, you know, EUA, emergency use approval, yeah?
Yeah.
So they haven't been trialed. That means they haven't gone through randomized control trials to show efficacy, validity and reliability, yeah?
Well, it's a surrogate
test.
Finish that and then I'll interject.
In this country, any medical test, like a prostate-specific antigen test or a mammography screening test or any test for a disease or illness or whatever, has got to be trialed within the National Health Service. The agency called NICE, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, has got to show evidence, good evidence, robust evidence, and that means a randomized trial, usually, always, that it works, the test works.
Yes.
Now, these tests will fast-track through because the paranoia and the hysteria, what I call the corona hysteria, that was generated from December last year onwards with the novel coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
So the hysteria removed the precautionary science principles, we call them, the precautionary principles in science, where you protect the public from faulty machinery, faulty drugs, faulty products.
Mm-hmm.
40 medicinal products. It's called the precautionary principle. You know that they don't do any harm because you've trialed them for a couple of years rigorously in several randomized controlled trials. That hasn't happened because the fear, the corona fear that was generated, the corona hysteria, they said, oh, we don't need to do that. Let's just get these things into practice. Let's fast-track them through.
Mm.
Very suspicious, that really,
yes.
In a disease that was,
yes.
You know, that was basically like a flu or a bad flu or influenza-like episode, as Carl Hennigan calls it. You know, why was this done to such the fear and hysteria that came out of China, that doctor that was shown, the one that supposedly died?
Yes.
Remember the one who did
the
video?
Yeah, of course.
Very mysterious story, that. People falling down in China. Do you remember all the videos we saw? The hysteria that created remove the normal precautionary principles in our National Health Service here, whereby protocols were applied very quickly that were developed from the World Health Organization, and tests like the PCR and the antibody tests for SARS-CoV-2 were introduced too rapidly without proper efficacy tests being done on them, without proper trials being run. Yeah, the trial can take several years.
Yes,
you know, it's not something that happens quickly. But of course, with the vaccines this year, they've been so quick, haven't they? You know, the Pfizer vaccine that we're now told has got a license in this country, its phase 3 is supposed to be 26 months follow up. How many months in this year, Eric?
Well, so we're now in the 12th month.
Yeah.
And this all started in March.
Yeah. So they start, even if they started it in March or April, right, that's still only what? Now we're in the 12th month minus three. That's 9 months. Say 8 to 9 months. But the phase three, it says 26 months follow-up.
That's phase three.
Oh, but no, we can extrapolate it. They probably extrapolated the safety data they've got already forward in time, like they filled in the sequences of the virus that didn't exist. Yeah?
Yes, it's hard not to conclude that this is intentional use.
It's modeling.
But when you look at all of this together, and when you recognize the history of the PCR back to at least 07, is 06 is saying there's a way to get 100% false positives. It's hard to not see the possibility that this is what they're using it for.
Well, I think we need to be careful when we use words like they. And,
yes, but we've got, are they?
I mean, we're talking, they are the public health agencies, like in the UK, it's Public Health England.
Mm-hmm.
In America, it's the
NIH, CDC.
CDSD, Center for Disease Surveillance and Control, Atlanta, Georgia. In this country, it's Public Health England. In other countries in Europe, it would be another public health agency, all linked to the National Health Services, because we have socialized medicine here. You know, we have a state-run system, basically, that you pay into by force. You don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And well, we do have private healthcare as well, but even the private sector here in the UK, it's governed, its science is governed by the National Health Service's health science. So mm-hmm. so it takes its rules from them. All these are the agencies we're talking about. These are the ones that are guilty. These are the ones that are culpable. Plus, the pharmaceutical companies that have generated the products, the tests, the drugs, the vaccines, these are the agencies working together. When we say they, that's what we mean by they. These are the targets for any litigation that must come now.
Mm-hmm.
There must be litigation against these agencies because they're totally culpable, in my view. They're culpable for misdirecting the science. Some people would argue they've lied, but let's just go with misdirecting. Misdirection of science for monetary gain, which is, you know, what more do we need? You know, how much more evidence do we need now to show that the PCR for SARS-CoV-2 is a flawed test that should not be used in National Health Services? And I'm saying this, Eric, because this is now not about misdirected science or science gone wrong or anything like that. This is now about power and control
mm-hmm.
and about enforcing a whole conformity to a set of beliefs about either technocratic medicine or how society and the financial organization, the economic order of our society should be framed. Because there's so much evidence now showing that the PCR test should be withdrawn, or at least testing should be stopped while proper trials are taken to see if this test is valid or not. Because there's so much evidence showing there's problems with it. But no, you're not seeing that happening. You're seeing the reverse. You're seeing the suppression of science, you're seeing the censorship of scientists, and you're seeing a sort of almost like a totalitarian response to the situation. And that doesn't happen in normal science. What I mean by normal science, I mean Thomas Kuhn's definition of normal science, which is that science proceeds by contest. So scientists show something works, others show it doesn't work,
mm-hmm.
and there's experiments to develop what's the truth. So the shift in the paradigm happens gradually, but it happens in normal science from the edges, from the contesters, the people who
yes.
contest,
the yes.
people who contest The accepted wisdom are always part of normal science. They're on the edge, but they're valuable. It's like Galileo and the Catholic Church, you know?
Yep.
And the paradigm gets overturned gradually, but the paradigm shifts quite rapidly, but the build-up to it happens in a momentum quite gradually. And that's what you're seeing now. You're seeing this crescendo, a momentum has developed around the PCR since it was used way back in January and December, the development of it. And now you're seeing almost overwhelming questioning of it. And that should shift the paradigm. It should flip very quickly into being retracted. Public health agencies saying we need to call a stop to testing and we need to look at this differently because there's so much evidence now showing there's problems with it. But you're not seeing that, Eric. You're seeing the reverse. You're seeing the clampdown and suppression and censorship. And that means we're into like a totalitarian Russian situation with this.
British Medical Journal said that. I mean, BMJ published an editorial. Let's see what date on the editorial where they said that it's the politicization. They decried in a 13th November editorial the politicization, corruption, and suppression of science. I will link to this below this. I have one more question for you, Kevin, that may fall right within your field. It seems to me that no matter what I've been interacting with the public on these issues all year long, and no matter what I might say or someone else might say about these problems, about any of this range of problems, someone will come back and say, "Why are all these people dying?" Or, "I had it in March," or, "I know someone who has it." Why are all these people sick? So what do we say to that?
Well, what we say to that, I mean, the answer to that is very simple. The answer to that is they've died or they've been given a diagnosis of COVID-19 after they've tested positive. It always comes back to the test.
Yes.
And therefore, people have had pre-existing conditions. They've been that's where the corruption of what I've called the differential diagnosis is important for people to understand. That because of the brainwashing and the propaganda around this, you know, that we've collected these very generic symptoms together and called them COVID-19. Therefore, anybody who presents with those symptoms has been labeled presumptively, presumed to have COVID-19. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Ahead of any PCR test, very often. Mm-hmm. They've been put on a care pathway for COVID-19 with those respiratory symptoms. But they may have asthma, they have may have COPD, they may have pneumonia, they may have all sorts of other conditions.
Hay fever. They may have a common cold.
Exactly.
They're so generic, like their primers.
Exactly.
One cough, Kevin. Every time I cough, I think, "Wow, one cough is described as a symptom of COVID."
Exactly. You see, that's the power of. It's what this French philosopher called Jacques Ellul said. Ellul. He said science has become propaganda, and it's a very good way of looking at what's happened this year with the so-called COVID science and the SARS-CoV-2 science, that what we've been given is really propaganda and brainwashing. The British government, the National Health Service, what they did, they created this behavioral insights team, which is what John Rappaport called a PSYOP team, to construct the messages for the public advertising here, which said anybody could have it, anybody could transmit it. And so this message went right out into the public sphere very early on in January or February. And it wasn't just the public, it was public health professionals, doctors and nurses were infected with this PSYOP. And so in their clinical practice, in their differential diagnosis, their decision-making was corrupted at a fundamental level. That's what I'd argue.
Yes.
How you'd explain this, you know, "Well, I know somebody who had it. You know somebody who was given the label COVID-19.
Yes.
You knew somebody who the doctor said had died from it. Show me the autopsy. That's what they've got to ask.
Yes.
Where was the autopsy result for that COVID-19? And what did the tissues look like in that autopsy? What did the pathologist say? What did they report on paper in black and white about that? Mm-hmm. And you know, you won't get that. Mm-mm. Because there aren't many autopsies, if any. And just to give you an example of that, we had the case of the young 19-year-old woman who died of COVID-19. And an investigative journalist, the journal's called Spiked Online, and people can Google this who listen to your program. They found out, the journalists found out that this 19-year-old COVID-19 death was no such thing. This woman had died with a congenital heart problem she'd had all her life. Because she'd reported a cough, and the doctors who treated her before her death recorded the woman had a cough, the doctor's diagnosis of heart disease was overturned by a coroner who put COVID-19 on the death certificate solely on the basis that the woman had a cough.
Oh. Yeah?
So a lot of people who have heart disease and heart failure have coughs, yeah?
Mm. Yes.
But a cough today can't just be a cough, can it? It's got to be COVID-19. Just as a high temperature today, it's got to be COVID-19. Or shortness of breath is COVID-19.
Yes.
Everything with those generic
symptoms that could... Look, I had a friend who had colon cancer. His first symptom was a fever.
Yeah.
So...
Exactly, but he'd be seen as, you see, this is what they did in the British National Health Service earlier in the year. In the mind of doctors and nurses working in the health service and physically in departments, they separated patients into two categories, those with the COVID symptoms and those without. So everybody had those COVID-like symptoms, was treated as COVID presumptively.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
What are they? But they're so broad and generic, it's an outrage.
Well, it's a bastardization of medical practice. It's a corruption of medical practice, and it's a fundamental corruption right at the heart of diagnostic medicine.
Yes.
And that's what makes it so pernicious. And in my view, and it's my view, can be shot down for this. That's what makes it evil to me. It's an evil action, this, because you're taking normal diagnostics and you're corrupting it fundamentally with this notion of COVID-19
yes.
and SARS-CoV-2.
Yes.
A virus that, you know, a test was developed with no viral isolate initially, and COVID-19, which is a set of generic symptoms. It's weaponizing cold-like symptoms back on the public. And I think that that's evil. And I think, and I'd argued in a paper already this year, that's what makes it Nazi-like. Because that's what the Nazis did in Germany in the 1930s. They said to the population, Jews, gays, they're all diseased, and they're going to infect the gene pool. Therefore, we need to eradicate them from the population.
Oh.
Jews, gays, gypsies, schizophrenics, people with learning disabilities. That's what they did in the 1930s. They excluded those people from the gene pool. They didn't want them infecting the Volk. That's history. People can look that up.
No. This is so frightening, because what you're suggesting here is that we are basically well into a eugenics program right now.
Well, I didn't use the word eugenics.
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you.
Well,
not,
I called it Nazification,
yes,
Eric.
A stronger word.
Well, command and control was what Nazi Germany was very efficient at doing, commanding and controlling right through the population with minimal force.
Yes.
People were dispatched with minimal force. Yeah. They didn't have Gestapo on every street with guns always. Population turned on each other. Now you've got this here in our population with people who are masked and those who are unmasked. People who don't wear masks in London have been attacked. Do you know that?
People have been attacked
for not wearing masks. So this is just symptomatic of Nazification, the command and control that's gone right through medicine and healthcare in this country. Around COVID and SARS-CoV-2 is very like Nazi Germany's command and control. And the German word, it's a long German word, and I can never pronounce it, Eric. People can look it up. It begins with G, Glutton, I can't pronounce it. But it translates in English to command and control. Yeah. It's, and I published an article called The COVID Nazification of the National Health Service, and it's on thetruthbarrier.com. Mm-hmm. People can Google it, it comes up. And that's basically what's happened in my analysis, my modest, you know, analysis of what's happened. And people can trash that or whatever, but I put that out there, and it makes sense to a lot of readers that that's what's happened. And people don't like that N-word, you know, Eric. They don't like that Nazification word. And I've always said to people, find me another word that combines command and control, mm-hmm. and I'll use it. Mm-hmm. And I never get a response.
Yeah. No, there's that postulate that if you bring up, whoever brings up the Nazis first loses the argument. I think that needs to be thrown out completely, because we're seeing this happen before our eyes. And I was marveling over this as well in the past day or so, that it takes so little physical force to do this, and the population mm-hmm. tends to cooperate with a totalitarian takeover, and that's how it happens. There's not enough soldiers to enforce a lockdown. It has to be convinced. And I think the mere possibility of that happening is not being discussed. And there's a few missing things, if I may interject them. One missing thing is I have never heard any of the public officials who are selling this notion of protecting the public from COVID ever once mention, we must do this and protect our liberty as a society. Mm-hmm. We must find a way to do this that does not destroy our way of life. That's thing one. Right. And with the mask, I think the thing that reveals the truth of the mask is in the States, there's a medical exemption pretty much everywhere. That the orders all say if medically tolerable. And this provision is ignored. That no one cares. You can say, well, masks work. Okay, great. But there are going to be people for whom they're very dangerous. Who have respiratory, who have cardiovascular issues, and all so forth, and they are included in the orders, but they are not included in the discussion. And this reveals the fraud of the mask. That's what tips the hand of the maskers.
Well, just if I could just come back on those two points,
please do.
Well, the first one, what was your first point, sir?
No one is talking about, you know, Cuomo doesn't say, let's protect the city, but not destroy the city.
Yes. They always argue for these, the lockdown rules, the lockdown prohibitions, the lockdown has always been argued in terms of safety for vulnerable groups. And as you rightly say, the word liberty and freedom is never in there. It's not about conserving our freedoms and protecting people. It's about us giving up our freedoms voluntarily to protect people.
Allegedly to protect
not
them.
Even voluntarily, by diktat, by government diktat, by what you call federal diktat or state diktat, or here, government diktat. And that in itself shows what this is about. It isn't about protection. It's about bringing in, on the back of this notion of there being an infective virus, draconian order that's going to fundamentally change how we do things, how we pay for things, who governs us, and how we're governed. So it's a governance, it's a technocratic order that's being manipulated into on the back of, we're being pushed towards on the back of this, what I call the fake narrative of COVID-19. It's a fake narrative. Mm-hmm. If we say the PCR is flawed, fundamentally, let's say that that's true. So it's a fake narrative of the virus. We're bringing in, you know, what you're bringing in America is frightening. You know, they're trying to destroy the Trump government. They're trying to destroy the Trump vote, all on the back of this. And I would argue that new order that is being brought in, and I don't like the word new world order, but basically it is, you know, whether we like it or not. It's a new order, a new form of governance. It's very like what they have in China, where you have people locked down, you have people with social credit ratings, you have people with health profile ratings that can't move around. You actually have an apartheid system in society. And you can see that coming already now with people who mask and don't mask. And on the mask issue that you mentioned, I'm involved, I'm a claimant in a judicial review taking the British government to the High Court, which is like taking your government to the Supreme Court in the States. We call it a judicial review, and we have that in the pipeline at the moment. It hasn't been given the green light yet by the government, but it's on their waiting list to look at our arguments. And in that judicial review, we found that none of the British government experts for COVID said to Boris Johnson and the cabinet that the public has to wear masks. They didn't say there's a scientific reason for that. So the British government have made this decision to say that people need to wear masks in shops, etc., based on the politics of COVID, not on the science. And that's a very key issue for people to hear, that there is no science behind masking. There's no research trial that shows that masks work and that protect you from viruses. And there's other evidence that's been excluded that shows the opposite, that masks are bad for you. You'll retain products of excretion are kept within your lungs, and they should be expelled. You know, and we all know this. People who worked in respiratory physiology know this. Physicians know this. But they've been brainwashed by this whole COVID science, which is a misdirection in science. Lysenko science, that's the word I was trying to remember earlier. Lysenko being the Russian agricultural scientist that misdirected Soviet agriculture for as much as 40 years, and it failed. And this is where we are now. A COVID science, SARS-CoV-2, it's Lysenko science. It's science misdirected. Now, the question that's got to be asked, Eric, is it misdirected on purpose, or is it unintentionally misdirected?
Well, there is a way of looking at the world where you can say that the effect was the intent.
Exactly. And in a way, you know, people, that argument's always used. Ignorance is, where you say, oh, you didn't know that there was such and such a law, and I'm sorry. And
yeah, ignorance of the law is no excuse.
No excuse. And so it'll be like that, I think, that, you know, look, the Nuremberg trials after the Second World War, when those scientists and doctors and went in front of the judges, they couldn't argue, I'm sorry, I was just doing my job. It didn't wash, did it?
Well, that was the principle. I mean, that's the first principle, is you can't argue that you're accepting an unlawful order. This gets very dicey.
It's very dicey. And you mentioned Imperial College London earlier, and Neil Ferguson, the epidemiologist who led all the projections in this country that were also used in the United States.
And Germany.
He projected there'd be 500,000 deaths in this country because of COVID-19 through a dodgy model, an incorrect algorithm that predicted this.
In the UK, he predicted 500,000 deaths.
500,000.
And 2.2 million in the United States.
That's right.
Of presumably
healthy
people.
Incorrect. Yeah, and in the same paper they published that, on page 4, I think it was, or it might be in 6, but you can Google it because it's all in the public domain, they said we do not examine the ethical or economic impact of our analysis. That's what they said. Mm. We do not look at the ethics or the economics or what the fallout of what we're saying. I would have failed any student of mine when I worked in university for a dissertational thesis who said that they do this analysis and they don't look at the ethical impacts. Because in healthcare, it's all about the ethical impacts of what you're doing. There isn't anything but ethics in healthcare.
Yep.
Healthcare is grounded on ethics, or it should be. And you know one example in history where medical practice was not grounded in ethics? Was Nazi Germany.
Yes.
And that's why that added to my argument about Nazification. That the scientist involved in this, right at the core of this whole so-called epidemic, don't work with an ethical radar or an ethical compass. Why not? All other scientists should, and they do. And when we do peer review, we pick that up. But of course, none of this work was ever peer reviewed. The Corman-Drosten paper looked like it was waded through in 24 hours. The Imperial College projection papers that we use right across the globe weren't peer reviewed. And why not? What was so empowered about their science that propelled it into the governments so quickly? What force, what power is behind that? And I would argue it's the usual suspects, it's vested mm-hmm. interest.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to think of a cabal of a Masonic lodge or people plotting in a corridor somewhere. The vested interest behind this were big pharma, corporations, huge, huge. I mean, look at the shares now in GSK and Pfizer and all these companies. You know, they're making billions every week from the governments of the world. They are going to be more powerful than any government. They already are,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not a conspiracy, but business as usual.
Well, I call it a confluence of interests, Eric. Mm-hmm. A confluence of interests. And the metaphor I use is, you know, when you look at a river and you plot a river's path through a country, mm-hmm. it starts with tributaries that come together. And they confluence together. They start moving in the same way because of the geology, because of gravity, because of all sorts of forces that are there and the terrain already. And they find a way of coming together. The tributaries come together. They get bigger and bigger and become less and less of them. And the river starts forming and it gets wider and wider and stronger and more forceful. And that's the metaphor I use here. I don't believe in people plotting, you know, I don't believe in Bill Gates phoned up Boris Johnson or, you know, phoned up China and said, let's get rid of Trump or anything like that. Of course, I'm sure something like that may have happened and they might well have done. I'm not interested in that. I look at vested interest. And, you know, I've worked in healthcare for 37 years. 37 years I was a registered nurse. 36 years a registered nurse. 1986. Oh, 37 years in healthcare, 34 years as an RN, as an academic. And anybody who's worked in healthcare in the British system, the European system, or the American and Canadian system, all know vested interests are huge in healthcare. Big pharma run it. They fund it. You know, this is what we know. We're well used to dealing with vested interests.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I think those have been the voices that have been the most powerful. And that's what we've got to push back from. These modest papers that have come out about the PCR, you know, why haven't they been looked at? Why isn't it being retracted? There's so much dissent from the official line, but none of it's going to impact. Because it's not about the science anymore, you know. It's Lysenko science. It's misapplied science, misdirected science, certainly. But it's more than that. It's now about power and control and about creation of a new economic order and destruction of what we've had, destruction of our freedoms, destruction of our human rights, and the creation of a new economic order. I call it a Chinification of the West,
yeah.
A Chinification, because, you know, that's the model that it's all come from and it's based on. The health passports that we're developing now in the UK are based on the Chinese algorithms, the Chinese software. The social credit system that's going to be brought in, it's already here, really, in an infrastructure form, is going to be similar to the Chinese version.
Yeah.
So there we go, you know, Chinification of the West. You know, maybe on one level you could argue this is actually a war, an economic and viral war, maybe a medical war that's been waged, you know, not like a traditional war where a country declares it's going to beat the other, you know, it's going to declare war on the other. and the other has to defend itself. Maybe this is a new form of warfare mm-hmm. that's economic, it's medical, and, you know,
data.
There's nothing more.
It's a data war.
It's a data war,
the,
yes.
The PCR is an AI device. It's part of the internet. Every one of those machines is on the internet. It's an AI device. It makes what it's looking for.
Yeah. And therefore, Eric, you know, if you look at the history of the Luddites and Luddism, you know, where people tried to fight the mechanization in the 19th century, the Industrial Revolution, and people fought with vaccination in this country in the 19th century. In Leicester, for example, people were forcibly vaccinated, and people rose up against the authorities. People mobilized. People used force against the authorities. And we're coming to a point, I think, we're certainly coming to a point here in the UK where there's going to be riots, and people will be killed fighting against the authorities. And I hate to say this, but until that happens, maybe people won't wake up. You know, we had the miners' strike in the 1980s in this country, Eric, and it polarized society when Margaret Thatcher wanted to shut the mines in this country and close down whole communities, whole groups in society suffered as a result of that economic decision, which had social ramifications and impacts. And people rose up, and it was only then when people saw the strikers and the police at war, like a war, the Orgreave strike, the Orgreave situation, it's called Orgreave, it's a place in the UK where the miners faced off the police, and it was more than a riot, it was like a battle. Mm-hmm. And it was called the Battle of Orgreave. And I predict that we will not stop this technocratic Chinification of the West until there is some sort of revolution. I'm using a small R for that, because I'm not talking about people rising up as a mass, but I'm talking about resistance and public disobedience, because that's what's happening now. And there will also then follow mass rebellion, I think, from that. Mm. And I'd like to be proved wrong on that, and I like to be shown that this is too dramatic and too, what have you, too extreme. But I can't see how you're going to stop. Look, all the academic papers in the world are not stopping the PCR, are they?
Well, okay, the public is becoming hip to this, and there's a rising tide on this issue. And I am interested in seeing how this works out, and I don't say that in a passive sense.
Yeah.
This has been my story this year. Is the PCR, and it's compelling, it's easy to understand, and it cuts the bottom out of the whole thing. So I think this is what you and your colleagues have done, or your colleague and his colleagues, including you, have done, I think, is the single most relevant and helpful thing that we've seen this year. And I personally was as I wrote to you, I didn't know whether to be overjoyed or start breaking plate glass windows with a baseball bat. I was so angry seeing it in such clear terms. But thank you. My listeners understand this issue, and I feel like I do my little part. I've got my little tent. I've got a few people who I speak to, and I try to be as clear as possible and then educate people to be educators. Yeah.
These co-authors, I'm last in the list, really. They're extremely highly credible people in that paper, far more credible than I am, and incredible that this has happened, that this paper and this retraction letter and the paper that goes with it have been written. I would argue this, it's seminal work. It's fundamental to turning this back. But I would also say, other people have said this before in different ways. I was saying it from March this year. I was saying it in different ways as a social scientist and not being listened to and being labeled as stupid, ignorant, and alarmist. But it's not alarmist to say the truth and to speak the truth. And the fact that this has been done with hard science, by hard scientists with very robust backgrounds, far more robust than mine, I would give that easily. Mm-hmm. I would say, that's very good. We've done this now. Now let's have this retracted now. Let's stop the testing and let's stand down. Let's stand down the technology of COVID-19, the medical technology. Let's put it on ice and stop doing the tests, stop doing the vaccines. Let's stop it now. And there's enough evidence there now to show that that should happen. What I'm saying, Eric, is if that doesn't happen, which I don't think it will, it's because this isn't about the virus. This is about a technocratic world order, a social order that's creeping in and being imposed on us for the wrong reason. The fake narrative of COVID-19 and the virus is being used to bring in this control, command and control, this Nazification of society, this Chinification, whatever word you want to. You know, Patrick Wood talks about technocracy, doesn't he? You know Patrick Wood's work.
I don't, but you know, Black Mirror is all very similar to Black Mirror.
Yeah, he's an American academic voice, talks about technocracy. He's been talking about it for a long time, and he's got a website, and he talks about this in relation to COVID and SARS-CoV-2. It's a technocratic order that's being brought in. Whatever way you want to discuss it, or people want to conceive it, New World Order, a technocratic world order, medical fascism, whatever. It's about loss of our liberty, you know. And in your country, you've got a written constitution, yeah? Mm-hmm. You've got a written constitution, which we don't even have in the mm-hmm. UK. Mm-hmm. Our constitution's run by people like Boris Johnson on a nod and a wink, and people who've been to Eton and Oxbridge, you know?
Yeah.
Like your Ivy League lot running the UK, the US. You can't have that in the US. Mm-hmm. Everything comes down to court of law in the US. Everything's contestable. There's checks and balances in the US system, which are wonderful, which we don't have in the UK.
No, it's a monarchy.
So that's what I would argue. But, you know, let's see now if this all goes into stasis and is put on ice. But if it's not, my argument is sound, that this is about a new order. This is about a new economic order. I live in the City of London, Eric, mm-hmm. which is the financial capital of the UK. It brings in, on certain analyses, up to 20% of the GDP for the UK, the City of London, the financial sector. It's like your Wall Street, but it's bigger, the financial sector here in the UK. Mm-hmm. And the City of London is dead. The City of London Corporation is really in a lot of trouble, that the local authorities that run the City of London, because the companies are keeping people at home. All the big finance companies have got people on furlough. The footfall in the City of London is normally 400,000 people a day who come in from the suburbs. It's less than a fifth of that every day. That's dead.
Yep.
It's dead. And it's dying. And it's killing. This is killing the financial spirit of this country. It's killing the cultural life of this country. It's already killed the medical life of this country, because the health service is now a COVID health service, a Nazified COVID health service. And art and culture are also destroyed, or soon to become destroyed, because you can't, if you've got no personal presence because of the misnotion of a virus and transmission, you can't create art, you can't create music, you can't create personal presence in an artistic sense. So the knowledge that's generated through art and culture can't happen anymore. It's killing our culture, you know? So, and also it's killing our spiritual lives as well, because we can't have church, we can't have, I'm a Roman Catholic, I can't go to the communion rite, unless it's some satanic ritual where the priest is wearing masks and gloves, I will not be party to that. Mm-hmm. So I see this not just scientifically, I see it across a spectrum that goes from science to spiritual. Yeah, mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, and I think we need to look at it that way and not be blinded, not merely be blinded by the fear of a virus. I tell you, if even if I believe this thing were real, I would not conduct my life any differently than I have in the past.
Oh, of course.
I have never worried about viruses and bacteria in
my
in the past.
My specialty, first piece of research before I looked at PCR was in respiratory physiology. That's what my master's degree is in nursing respiratory physiology, patients with respiratory diseases, COPD, asthma, etc. And I did experimental work as a nurse specialist in that area. So that I know this whole issue about masks is totally fallacious, and has been the arguments proposing masks are totally flawed, totally without good, robust evidence, and it should never have been accepted in any country. And in fact, do you remember this came in gradually, because initially WHO and health authorities said we don't need to wear masks. Do you remember?
Yes.
So this came in because of the
politics. One day in March.
Yes, and it came in because of political decisions, not medical decisions. Mm-hmm. Look, I worked in with TB patients, people with respiratory tuberculosis, mm-hmm. with lung tuberculosis. You know, we've gone, people, the way the expert evidence has been abused is totally pernicious, right? They've taken worst case scenarios and they've exacerbated them.
Yep.
That's then translated into a government message to wear masks.
Yep. Everything is a worst case scenario magnified by the next one with no evidence.
Well, I will not wear a mask. I will not wear a mask, and I won't even enter into a discussion about it when I go into a shop or anything. If they don't want me to be there and they don't want to take my money, I always say, Eric, when I go into a shop, they ask, where's your mask? I immediately say, do you want me to pay for something in this shop and to give you money to help your job or not? And the answer is always yes, and then we don't even bother with talking about masks. Mm-hmm. I will not even engage with it. And if they want to have an apartheid society like they did in South Africa based on whether you mask or not, bring it on. Bring it on, because it won't last. It won't last. Mm-hmm. That's what they're trying to do. And they're not doing it through police on the street, and they're doing it through trying to turn the population against itself.
Yes.
Against people who don't mask. And I will not accept having an exemption card or a lanyard, because I have no medical problem. I'm 65, untested, no medication. I'm quite well, thank you very much. I'm the thinnest I've been since I was 21. And because I'm 65, I will not be treated as a vulnerable person. Age is only a number, yeah? Mm-hmm. And I will not adopt this sick role, this disabled image to get out of wearing masks. I think that's playing along with this. We need to confront this straight head on. And when you confront it head on, it backs away from you. Have you noticed? It only works through your submission.
Yes.
It only works through. And this is what they'll do with the vaccinations. They will bring it in and they will raise the issue of mandatory vaccines in this country, but they won't enforce that. They can't. Mm-hmm. They won't. It won't work. And they'll bring it in through trying to create an apartheid state, where you've got those who are vaccinated, those who aren't. They did that before in the 19th century, and it didn't work. If you look at the history of Leicester, the city of Leicester in the UK, it opposed vaccination, it opposed mandatory vaccination for smallpox, and it overturned the authorities, and the authorities had to back off. And there were wars in the street in Leicester. People died, and people were put in prison. And that's what's going to happen in this country if this goes any further. You will find resistance, a resistance not just physical and violent resistance, but non-engagement with the authorities, public disobedience. There'll be a whole spectrum of resistance that will be impossible to control, impossible to control. So that's the message I'd give Boris Johnson, if you could get them around the table to debate this. And you can't do that in this country. None of the official scientists or the politicians will go to an open debate about this, because they say there is no debate.
Yep.
You know, the science is all certain. And the science is never certain. That's the definition of science. It's always open to debate. Normal Science, Thomas Kuhn, that's the book to read, The Structure of Scientific Revolution. Science is always debatable. The most accepted wisdom is always questionable. You know?
Kevin, what is the name of that book?
And then, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn, K-U-H-N.
K-U-H-N.
Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn.
Got it.
I think it's called that. Mm-hmm. Must just check.
I'll put an Amazon link up.
Yeah, have a link up to it. And basically, you know, all accepted wisdoms are questionable. And any academic contract that I've ever had, and I've had six academic contracts with six different universities in the UK, there was always a clause in my academic contract that said I was able and would be supported in contesting accepted wisdoms. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean by accepted wisdoms?
Yep,
truisms. Things that we think are above question. Academics are always allowed to question it because that's how frontiers are opened up. Always through contested wisdoms. Yeah. Think of Galileo. Think of the Catholic Church in Galileo's time and Copernicus. And you have basically where we are now. The Mike Yeadens, who helped create this paper we're talking about today, they're the Galileos of today. I'm you know, way down on the list. They're the Galileos. They're up there. They're contesting the accepted wisdoms, and they will win because they'll have right. We have right on our side, you know. And I know that, and I have say that with this. My hand on my heart, but I see it not just medically and scientifically, but also spiritually, economically, and all sorts of ways. I can see this, it, you know, and that's how you can triangulate across all these different perspectives on the situation. And I would say, you know, that it's going to be stopped. Now, how it stopped, I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see how it stopped and overturned. But I can't see it lasting. Technocracies, you know, totalitarian states don't last. They don't last forever. Yeah. If you look at Russia, if you look at the East German bloc, they didn't last forever. China, I don't know. You know, I have to say that I put my money with Trump on China. And who was the scientist that he had helping him with China? Peter, he brought him in from California, I can't remember his name, but he wrote all the books on Chinese economy and Chinese corporate interests in the States and the products and how they were faulty. And, you know, the whole Belt and Road approach that China has to destabilize economies and to asset strip and basically to economically overturn, I think is what's happening here now with us. And maybe that's a dramatic analysis, but I can't see that it's about a virus any longer and a disease. That's just the opportunity to bring in this whole way of looking at things in a technocratic, a reductive, and an inhuman perspective, an inhuman way, I'd argue. Mm-hmm.
Kevin, I must wrap up. Thank you so much for your contribution.
Okay, I hope that's useful to your listeners, and thank you very much for having me on the show.